The following is an encore broadcast of Up to Date. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. One reason the tsunami that struck South Asia was so devastating is because it came out of nowhere. Back in the U.S., David Laskin has written a book about another disaster that came out of nowhere right here in the heartland. He calls it the Children's Blizzard of 1888. When that day began, the weather was so mild that children went off to school without heavy coats and hats, but hours later, the sky exploded in a raging chaos of horizontal snow and hurricane-force winds. When it was over, some 500 people were dead, many of them children who died on their way home from country schools. David Laskin joins us on the phone from Seattle this morning. His book is called The Children's Blizzard, and the timing of this conversation couldn't be much better given the conditions in the Kansas City area again this morning. David, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Nice to have you on the phone today. Why did you want to write a book about a blizzard?
Well, you know, I've always been a weather nut. Some people are sports nuts, some people are garden nuts, and I'm just a weather nut. And, you know, I think snow is my favorite kind of weather. I'm sorry to be a little bit lighthearted about this, because obviously this book is not a lighthearted book. This is
right.
A book about great suffering and in many cases tragedy that hit the Prairie Plains region in 1888. But, you know, I think there's always a dilemma for people fascinated by weather, because on the one hand, you're just mesmerized and awestruck by the power and beauty of weather. But on the other hand, that intense weather is often the kind that causes most suffering for people. So there's kind of a split personality, and I think all weather forecasters would attest to this, between awe and pity. You know, those are the two
right.
prevailing emotions of weather nuts.
You know, this storm was extraordinary in so many ways, and I want to make sure that people get the idea that this was far from just an ordinary blizzard. First, it seemed to literally come out of nowhere, and unprecedented is what you write about it in its suddenness and violence. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, that's absolutely correct. You know, the Prairie region is a region of weather extremes, and anybody who lives there knows that all too well. This is an area, you know, tornadoes are common, cold fronts just come ripping through, dropping the temperatures rapidly, prolonged periods without rain, then torrential rains. But what struck me in reading the pioneer accounts of this storm, time after time after time, people said they had never seen anything like this. And again, what was the hallmark of this storm was the suddenness. The day was not absolutely clear in all regions, and again, I really kind of covered the region in terms of my research. Some places reported some overcast, some places reported filtered sunshine. Everybody remarked on how warm it was. This had been a very, very cold winter, in a series of cold winters, in many places week after week of double digits below zero, and then suddenly it warmed up to the 20s, in some cases the 30s. So it felt like the January thaw. It felt balmy. You know, everything's relative when it comes to weather. And then people went out, people watered their stock, people went to town, children went to school. Everybody just got out because this seemed like the day to do it. And then people describe it as an explosion. Again and again you hear the comparisons to trains, the roar of a train, which of course was the loudest sound anybody heard on the prairie in those days before cars and planes and other more
right.
Loud noises. So, yeah, that was its hallmark. It just came without warning. People literally turned their backs, turned around, and there it was, this wall of ice and snow bearing down on them.
You also write this about the storm, David. The air was so thick with fine ground, wind-lashed ice crystals that people could not breathe.
That's
amazing.
Yeah. And I am not a meteorologist myself, but I have been blessed with good working relationships with a lot of people in the National Weather Service and academic researchers in weather, and they actually explained to me what went on here. And you know, I hate to draw another tragic comparison, but this was something that someone in the National Weather Service actually drew for me, which was, he said, think of the way the lower Manhattan streets looked on September 11th with all of that smoke and ash just billowing chaotically.
Mm-hmm.
He said that's the kind of situation that we had in this storm, where there were these horizontal winds picking up the snow that was on the ground, taking the snow that was falling from the sky, and pulverizing it. So this was not gossamer, crystalline, Christmas card snowflakes kind of gently sifting down. This was snow and ice that had been really put through a kind of grinder. And again, time after time in the accounts that I read, people compared it to flour or sand.
Hmm.
But imagine frozen sand blowing on 40 to 60 mile an hour winds. So these were crystals that had been shattered and then picked up by the wind and hurled. Hmm. And yeah, so it was, you know, if you imagine trying to walk into that and breathe, very difficult. And it also, people talked about how it went through their clothes, even into their underwear.
Hmm.
That's, you know, this is before Gore-Tex and before all the synthetic fabrics that keep us warm. So people were wearing wool and cotton, and it just plastered them.
How did you first hear about this storm?
Well, I have written other books about weather. This is kind of a lifelong passion. And the first book I did was called Braving the Elements. And that my publisher gave it the rather corny subtitle of The Stormy History of American Weather. And in that book, I have a chapter on history on weather in the West. And the book begins really with the settlement of the country. And I have a lot about what the pilgrims and the, you know, first arrivals from Europe made of the weather here. And then as people work their way west, obviously the weather becomes quite different. And once you cross the Mississippi and cross the 100th Meridian, you know, you just get into a whole different weather regime. Well, in the course of researching that, and again, I tried to draw on as many firsthand and contemporary accounts as I could, that was where I came upon the first references to what is often known as the school children's blizzard.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the storm that everybody who survived it in Nebraska and the Dakotas and in Minnesota, those are the states that it hit hardest, that's where you get account after account of what happened that day. And I guess there was one by a schoolboy who describes these kind of huge clouds just bearing down on his school, and then the school is actually blown off of its cobblestone foundation when the wind hits. That stuck in my mind, and I just thought, gee, someday I'd like to write about that. And that day came.
And you point out, David, that the settlers of these areas were not people who were prone to exaggeration, and their accounts were so filled with amazement that set spoke to you pretty loudly, too.
Yes, absolutely. You know, these were stoic people. Many of them, many, many people of Scandinavian origin. And most of the accounts and most of the settlers of this region were immigrants. There were many from Scandinavia, many Germans, quite a few Mennonites. I traced their stories all the way back to Europe and how they came over in this great migration of 1873, and then some Yankees, Civil War veterans, and so on, who were drawn to, especially to Dakota during the Dakota boom of the 1880s. These were hardworking, stoic people, didn't really have time to write a lot, certainly did not reveal their feelings. And yet, often the only thing that they ever wrote was an account of the storm.
Hmm.
And, you know, there was one that I really just filled me with wonder. It was written by a Norwegian fellow named Ole Rolvag. I mean, it's not Rolvag, Rolag.
Mm-hmm.
I mixed up with the author, Rolag. And he said, you know, many people doubt that this was the big storm and say, oh, it couldn't have been that bad. Well, I'll tell you, those people were sitting inside by their fires and hadn't gone out in it, because anybody who did go out in it, and in fact he did that day, they know this was the storm to remember. So it just, I think its ferocity moved them, and also the human suffering, the fact that so many of the victims were children, this is something that really moved and marked them deeply for their lives.
What exactly is the meteorological formula for a major blizzard like this, David?
Okay, well, it's a little complicated, but I'm going to try to simplify it a little bit. There are a couple of elements at play here. First of all, there was very, very, very cold air up in Canada,
mm-hmm.
and central Canada, and it was just kind of sitting there and pooling and getting colder and stagnating, and that probably started early in January. And then there was a low-pressure system that was starting to form and come in, sailing in on the jet stream, which was, you know, was kind of the storm track, as we call it. And then the third element was that there was extremely warm air down in the Gulf of Mexico, warm, humid air, and that started working its way north. So it was really that the low-pressure system was what drew the frigid air and the warm air together, and the contrast between those two air masses was kind of like fuel that, that really, that was the fuel, that was the energy that got this thing whipped up. And what happens is, as the front forms, you know, this is kind of feedback at play. So the contrast of the air masses made the low more powerful. As the low intensified, it sucked in winds and, you know, this kind of a vacuum in the atmosphere. That heightened the difference between the air masses, the difference in pressure between the air masses, and that in turn strengthened the cold front. So it all kind of fed off each other, and those are the elements. You know, the Rocky Mountains played a force, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, as the jet stream crosses the mountains, that again changes the pressure of air. So it was those that came together. But I think really the explosion here was because of the contrast, the strong contrast between the cold air and the warm air. And what happened was after this front came through, some of the coldest temperatures on record were felt in this region. And I know in particular, I think about a week later, it was down in the minus 40 range up in most of the region. And in fact, the cold front was so powerful that it traveled all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. So, yeah, it was quite a severe outbreak of Arctic weather.
You know, my folks live in Minnesota, and if you haven't experienced 40 and 50 and 60 below wind chill factors, you just haven't lived yet. It really is an extraordinary thing to experience. Yeah. I was wondering about the people who you describe who experienced this storm, the settlers of the Dakotas and Nebraska. These folks came here from Europe, and they were told that the American prairie was the perfect place to live, right?
Right. You know, I don't want to point fingers, but there was a lot of misinformation going around. What happened was there was all of this land that became available for settlement. A lot of it was owned by the railroads, and a lot of it became available through the Homestead Act. And the railroads, obviously, were very eager to sell off these huge holdings that had been granted by the government. Also, they would make more money from freight charges and having towns built and so on. So they actually hired agents that kind of fanned out over Europe, and they wrote, I've actually came across some of their publications in Norwegian, that they, these kind of sunny brochures that describe the conditions in the Dakotas and in the Great Plains, and they described it as the perfect climate. It's, you know, it's actually kind of funny to read these. I mean, they say, winters are light and mild, and, you know, what little snow there is tends to just be enough to sort of dampen the fields. It melts off quickly. It's bracing and salubrious, and they make it sound almost like a spa, that there's this just wonderful place. You know, they stress that there are no trees, which that was true, and, you know, you just need to tickle the soil with your plow, and it will yield incredible harvests. Abundant rain falls when you want it, and you know, it just kind of sounds like the Garden of Eden.
But that wasn't exactly the way it was, right?
sometimes it is, and I think that's the deceiving. I mean, obviously, winters are always more severe than that. But you know, there were a series of good years in there in the 1880s, and you know, I think that the key factor, obviously, when you get into the more arid regions is rain. And, you know, that's certainly a factor in western, you know, the western Dakotas and western Nebraska. And there were some rainy summers. So people were actually doing pretty well for a while. But as you know, it's a region of change. And you get some good regimes that set up and some bad regimes. And by the late, in some ways, I think what was so interesting about this blizzard was that it heralded a change. I mean, this was a major storm that created widespread havoc and tragedy. But then more suffering set in. There was a series of very, very hot, dry summers in the late 1880s, and it was kind of the end of the boom. It was the end of the period of optimism and rosy feelings in that region, and it was the beginning of harder times to come.
If you're just joining us, we're talking today with author David Laskin, whose new book is called The Children's Blizzard, and it chronicles a storm that hit the Great Plains states in 1888. Well, one of the great hardships these folks had to endure, David, were grasshoppers. Yes. Tell us about the grasshoppers.
Well, again, this is something that, you know, in some ways I wish I could have gone back in a time machine and seen it for myself, because it's unimaginable.
Yes.
But once again, you know, you read these descriptions, and the first one sounds like, they're kind of stretching it, and then you reach another and another and another, and they just, you know, they can't all be stretching it. Basically, there was this plague. You know, there's no other way to describe it. And these locusts would just cover the sky. They would come in summer. And the thing that just made it so heartbreaking is that often it would happen kind of in late summer. So your crops would be coming along. You'd think, okay, this is going to be the year where we get out from behind, where we have the good harvest, where the wheat comes in, where we're really going to, you know, begin to make it in this new world. And then these things come in, you know, black in the sky. They land, they cover the fields, and they just eat everything up. I mean, even people, accounts I found, you know, they would eat people's clothing. They would cling to curtains and eat the curtains. You know, if you left your shirt outside, it would be consumed. And they would just, you know, you would hear this crunching, this horrible crunching sound. And it was just this devastation. And, you know, there were, again, this was cyclical. So there were a series of years. I think the 1870s was bad. Then they let up for a while, and then they came again. And, you know, I have this description of one of the families that I write about who experienced the storm. They came from Norway, and first they were in Iowa for a little bit, kind of getting on their feet and earning some money, and then they headed west, and they just described going through this grasshopper country which had been obliterated, and people heading the other way said, oh, you'll be leaving by next summer. The grasshoppers will wipe you out. There's no way that you're going to survive. And they said, you know, it just looked like a desert. Everything had been picked clean. And I'm actually not quite sure what happened. I know that exact species of locust became extinct.
I was going to say, they're not here anymore. Yeah.
They're not here anymore. Thank goodness. And I think there actually may be another book. I saw a reference to a book about this plague. So sounds like another interview. But I know that in the 1870s and 1880s, it was really bad. And it was, you know, I kind of think of it as the biblical plagues. And grasshoppers was one, and, you know, diphtheria was another. This was a disease that just ravaged the region of the pioneers, and obviously bad weather and blizzards was one of the others.
If you're just joining us, our guest this hour is author David Laskin. His new book is called The Children's Blizzard. David, let's talk about weather forecasters and the science of weather forecasting, and how did it come to be that weather forecasters so utterly failed their ability to predict this storm rolling in that day?
Well, let me make a small correction before I continue with that. They actually did not fail, and it's actually a really interesting story, and one that I tell in detail in the book. Let me just give a little bit of background. In those days, national weather forecasting was done by the U.S. Army, and it was done by a branch of the Army called the Signal Corps, the Signal Office. And this had started in 1870, and basically, it had all been kind of centralized in Washington, D.C., and it was all the readings came in by telegraph, and they'd have these signal officers sitting in an office, and they'd get all the temperature and humidity and wind and so on data from all over the country, and then they would figure out where the low-pressure systems were. They didn't know about cold fronts in those days, so it was basically, forecasting was basically a matter of tracking pressure systems, and they would map them out, and then they'd send out the forecast. Well, in October of 1887, they decided to try an experiment and to send a forecaster out to St. Paul to open up an office. So again, you know, nowadays we've got forecast offices all over the country. Now it's still centralized. They run the big computer models in Washington, D.C., but the forecast for your own region is going to be done in an office staffed by people who really know the region. Mm-hmm. But that was not the case back in 1887 and 1888. So this was something new. This was an experiment, and they took a career officer by the name of Thomas Woodruff, and I read all the correspondence, which is in the National Archives, posted them out there. He was married and had a kid, but he had to leave his wife and child behind, and he opened up this office. So he was in charge of forecasting what they called cold waves, which is a term we don't use anymore, but it's pretty easy to figure out what it is. It's the opposite of a heat wave. Mm-hmm. And these were, you know, kind of what they most cared about, because these were Arctic outbreaks that would be most destructive. Well, I actually was able to follow Woodruff's whereabouts and his forecasting and his thought process in the days surrounding the storm, and I actually held in my hands these little pieces of tissue paper on which he wrote the forecast, and he did say for January 12th, 1888, that it was going to snow in Dakota Territory. He said it was first going to get warmer, which it did, and then it was going to snow, and then it was going to get colder, and the snow was going to drift. So he got all of that right. But the real tragedy, well, there's a couple of tragedies. One is that, well, there's just no way to get the word out. I mean, he did that forecast about midnight the night before, and then it goes out on the telegraph lines, and nobody's really up at midnight, but when they get up the next morning at 7 or 8, when they... And it goes out to on the railroad line, so it goes to railroad agents and to Signal Corps offices, kind of data gathering stations. There are little huts and also army forts, that the army had out on in the frontier. Well, by the time they get them, it's about 7 or 8 in the morning, and they can tell whoever is nearby. But if you're living out on the prairie and if your kids are going to a one-room schoolhouse that they're going to walk a mile from home, no telephones, no cars, no radio, mm-hmm. no TV. And so I actually did come upon stories of railroad agents who had seen these telegrams and saw kids walking to school in towns and would say, there's this huge blizzard coming. Turn back. Go home. Don't go to school. So there were some lives saved because word was getting out. But in most cases, there was absolutely no word that got out in time. Now, Woodruff actually did send out a cold wave warning, which triggered a process whereby all of the weather, all of the signal office people would raise flags that would show that a cold wave was coming, and that meant a drop of temperature of 30 degrees in the next 12 hours or so. So the flags went up, and, again, there was warning, but the flags went up, and I actually have all the records of exactly when this happened. In many cases, it was about 20 minutes before the storm hit. So A, not enough time, and B, okay, if you were living within sight of a signal office and saw the flag, you might kind of take shelter or get your stock in or what have you. But, again, there were very, very few people who were able to see it. So they knew the forecast, but it just didn't get out in time.
And, David, it's just amazing to me that this kind of research and this kind of documentation is still around this many years later. It's incredible you came across this stuff.
Yeah, well, God bless the National Archives. They have everything there. It's sometimes hard to find. You have to be patient. But, yeah, I was astounded, too, at the amount of detail I could uncover.
We're re-airing an interview with David Laskin, author of The Children's Blizzard. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. We're talking today about the Great Blizzard of 1888 that author David Laskin calls the Children's Blizzard in his book. I want to go to some phone calls right now from folks who have been waiting a little bit. Gary from Mission, you're on Up to Date.
Yeah, I wonder if the author is writing about the same event that I read about in Laura Ingalls Wilder's Little House book. She writes pretty vividly of a blizzard, and I'm pretty sure it's the same one. And I wondered if he used that as part of his research material.
Yeah, well, thanks for that question. Actually, that Laura Ingalls Wilder book called The Long Winter, which has a series of blizzards in it, was really one of the books that inspired me. In fact, that was not the same winter. The Long Winter was the winter of 1880 to 81, and that began on October 15th with a sudden blizzard that took everybody by surprise. And those blizzards just kept coming and coming that winter, and then there was so much snow that the trains were stopped for weeks, and then by spring, when the snow finally melted, there were huge floods. I actually read that book to my kids, and I think I enjoyed it even more than they did, and they loved it well enough. It was just spellbinding, and I found when I do actually talk about that winter in my book, and I do actually quote from Laura Ingalls Wilder's account in which she has the character based on herself and some of her friends talking about what they would do if they were to get caught in a storm and how they would survive, which was a little bit of a kind of foreshadowing of what was happening. I found in my own research that everything that she wrote about winters on the prairie was absolutely matched up detail by detail with what the pioneers wrote. I mean, she didn't make this stuff up. And, you know, I think when you read it, especially if you're not from that part of the country, you go, gee, how could that be? And how could they have drifts that were over their roofs? And how could the train stop for that long? And how could they survive by bundling hay and burning it? Well, it all happened, yeah. So I have huge reverence for her and those books. And thanks for that question.
Thank you, Gary.
Can I ask one more question?
Real quickly, sure.
Was this the storm that killed most of the cattle of the West that was so famous?
Well, that was yet another storm. That was the winter before, and that was called the winter of blue snow, and that was really what wiped out the cattle kingdom. There was this huge kind of bonanza ranching that was going on. And the previous winter was also very severe. Again, there was a series of storms, and I do discuss that at length in my book as well. So that was the winter of 1886 to 87. That was the previous winter, and that was most severe farther west. And in fact, if you read biographies of Teddy Roosevelt, you'll see that his own holdings were seriously affected by that winter. So, yep, it's all in the book.
Gary, thanks for your call, and let's say hello to Don from Farley, Missouri. Good morning, Don.
Hi. My grandmother remembered that blizzard. She died in the 50s, but the reason she survived was because a teacher kept them at school, and they didn't. She was raised in a sod house in South Dakota, 30 miles west of Sioux Falls, between Canastota and Montrose, South Dakota. And teacher kept him in school, and she talked about that, how terrible it was, and how farmers and people went out to try to save their cattle and stuff like that, and they couldn't get back to the house because they couldn't see to find the place.
Well, Donna, our author has some great accounts in his book of school children being caught in this storm and the fateful decisions that teachers made about whether to send the kids home that day or not. So, again, thank you for your phone call, Donna. It was good to have you. I want to invite some of our KCUR staffers into the studio now to read some excerpts from this book because David has some great descriptions here of what happened on the day this storm blew into the Dakotas and Nebraska and exactly what happened there. So joining us right now is Sylvia Maria Gross, Bill Anderson, and Michael Byers. And Sylvia, why don't you start out here and read a little bit from part of this book.
To those standing outside, it looked like the northwest corner of the sky was suddenly filling and bulging and ripping open. In account after account, there runs the same thread, often the same words. There had never been anything like it. Settlers who had lived through the blizzards of 1873 and the recurring storms of the snow winter of 1880 to 81 and the vicious blizzards that had killed so many cattle just the previous winter, none of them had ever seen a storm come up so quickly or burst so violently.
My brother and I were out snowballing on a bank, remembered Allie Green, a 15-year-old boy in Clark County in eastern Dakota Territory. We could see the blizzard coming across Spirit Lake. It was just as still as could be. We saw it cut off the trees like it was a white roll coming. It hit with a 60-mile-an-hour wind. It had snowed the night before, about 2 or 3 inches. It just sucked up that snow into the air and nearly smothered you. It was like a gray wall, said H.G. Purcell, a schoolboy in neighboring Cottington County who stood in awe on a ball field at the edge of town as the storm bore down from the northwest.
We were all out playing in our shirt sleeves without hats or mittens, remembered a South Dakota schoolboy. Suddenly we looked up and saw something coming rolling toward us with great fury from the northwest and making a loud noise. It looked like a long string of big bales of cotton, each one bound tightly with heavy cords of silver, and then all tied together with great silvery ropes. The broad front of these cotton bales looked to be about 25 feet high. Above them, it was perfectly clear. The phenomenon was so unusual that it scared us children, and several of us ran into the schoolhouse and screamed to the teacher to come out quickly and see what was happening. When the storm reached the schoolhouse a few moments later, it hit with such force that it nearly moved it off its cobblestone foundation, and the roar of the wind was indescribable.
The sky was inky, wrote a teacher at the Rosebud Indian Agency in Dakota, just north of the Nebraska line. Lilia, another teacher, ventured a few yards out of the front door at its beginning and was near not getting back. The wind struck her with such violence as to bring her head down to her knees and take away her breath. She said she was near falling on her face, and she knew that if she fell, she would not get up again.
That's Sylvia Maria Gross, Bill Anderson, and Michael Byers. Thank you all for those readings. And David, was it difficult to find those passages to include in your book?
Not really. Well, first of all, let me thank the staff for beautiful readings.
Yeah, they were great.
Yeah, that was wonderful. No, you know, there's. I think the hardest thing was actually deciding what not to put in. There's just a huge amount of information out there. Pretty much any county history or local history has something on the blizzard. The archives are just full of accounts. I had very good success in Pierre, South Dakota, at the South Dakota State Archives. There's a whole box after box of accounts of in the Pioneer Daughters. They had this oral history project a couple decades ago in which the daughters of the pioneers wrote down accounts of their mothers' lives and many, many blizzard accounts in there. The research was, I think the hardest thing was, again, deciding what not to put in. And I guess for me, really, since I'm not from that region, kind of getting up to speed on what life was like.
Mm-hmm.
I did a lot of background reading about country schools, one-room schoolhouses, the settlement of the region, what it was like to farm. And I was particularly interested in getting the very first impressions of pioneers, especially European pioneers, what they thought when they, you know, they'd travel by ship from Europe. They'd land, in many cases, in New York. This is before Ellis Island, so they were not processed there, but at Castle Garden, mm-hmm. as it was known then, in Lower Manhattan. And then they get on a train, and they'd go out there, and then they'd get off a train. And it was from that point that I was really fascinated by what they saw and what they felt and just their descriptions. And some of my favorite are these Norwegian families who came, and they were all bundled up with their traveling clothes, and they were wearing these heavy wools, and they'd get off in the summer, and they would be absolutely frying, and you know, then they would instantly get terribly sunburned. Mm-hmm. These are fair-skinned blonde people from Scandinavia, and they were out in the Dakota Prairie in July, and with no protection from the sun, so things like that really captured the feel of it for me.
And these folks, a lot of them anyway, came out here on boxcars, on these big trains,
yep.
right? Just
yep.
sort of like cattle herded onto a big car.
Well, yeah, they were called immigrant cars, and they were conditions are pretty primitive. Some of them actually did travel with their cattle. There was you know, places for livestock, and there were many complaints actually. One of the strands that I follow in the book is this group of Swiss-German Mennonites. They were German-speaking of Swiss origin, and they called themselves Schweitzers, and they had actually traveled all over Europe due to religious persecution, but ended up in the Ukraine and then immigrated from there in a group of, I think, 40 or 50 families in 1873. And they tried to arrange with the railroads to get special cars that would take them out. I think they went out to Yankton, South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that the conditions on the trains were just terrible. And the other thing was that, you know, the train journey took several days, and the conductors refused to stop long enough in any stations for them to get any food or water.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were suffering terribly. And finally, they rebelled, and the men just got off. And I remember exactly where it was, but somewhere in the Midwest, and they got off and they just went into town, and the conductor was blowing the whistle, and they just said, no, we're not coming back till we can get some food and water for our family. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was not, they were not traveling in luxury or comfort.
Now, the thing that strikes you about this particular storm is, as our readings indicated, this thing hit so quickly and with such fury that school teachers and school kids had to make these decisions about, do we stay at school, do we venture out and try to make it home? In some cases, just a couple of hundred yards, or in other cases, a mile or two. But decisions made very, very quickly and with obviously life and death consequence, right, David?
That's right. You know, again, you have to put yourself back in the shoes of these people. And many of the stories I write about, the teachers themselves are 19 years old or 20 years old. Now, I have kids that age, and I shudder to think how difficult it would be for them to be faced with that kind of decision. I mean, here you are, you know, you're a college sophomore, say, and you've got a room full of kids, and this storm hits, and in many cases, these teachers were not from the region. They were brought in, hired by the, you know, very small school districts, or whatever, you know, even if they were from the region, again, people emphasized, and we heard in this reading that nobody had ever seen anything like this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, obviously you'd think, well, why didn't they just stay? That would have been the most logical thing. You know, why risk your life? Well, in some cases, there was no fuel, and these buildings were not insulated. So, these, you know, when a cold front like that hits, it doesn't take very long before the temperature inside becomes very close to the temperature outside. In some cases, the roofs blew off. And there's this one famous story of a Nebraska teacher named Minnie Freeman.
I was going to ask you about her, yeah.
Minnie, the famous Minnie Freeman, yeah. And you know, she let her kids out. Well, the door blew off, and she closed it, and then, you know, she nailed it shut, had one of the kids nail it shut, and then the roof blew off. And so they knew there was absolutely no way. But, you know, in other cases, sadly, they could have stayed. You know, they the kids had brought a little bit of food for their lunches, and in some cases hadn't eaten at all, and there was some fuel. But they just said, well, you know, the nearest farmhouse is a quarter of a mile away. You know, think of a football field. It's really not much longer than going from one end to the other.
Yeah.
That's not a big deal. We can make it. And, you know, yeah, on most days, even in most winter storms, they could have made it. It was just that in this one, there was what meteorologists call zero-zero visibility. You can't see up. You can't see sideways.
You couldn't see the hand in front of your face in some cases. It was that intense.
Yeah,
and you describe at one point one group of students going out and being able to follow a fence line for a while as their guidepost. But in many cases, these kids didn't have that, and they were literally at a loss.
Yeah. This was the early days when the prairie was even more featureless than it is now. I mean, now people, you know, often the farmers have planted windbreaks or their fences or what have you. But in those days, there was pretty much nothing. So no visibility, no landmarks. And if you miss, if you're heading for that one house that's a quarter of a mile away, but you veer off, and think how easy it is to miss when you have 60-mile-an-hour winds blowing from the northwest, you're dead. You know, there's just nothing. You walk by that house, and you're just out in the middle of nowhere. And that was really what happened in most of the stories that I follow. They thought, okay, we know where to go. We're going to head right there. And they got blown off course. Everybody got blown to the southeast, no matter how well they thought they knew the terrain. The wind was so strong, it blew them off.
Let's say hi to Mickey from Mission. Good morning, Mickey.
Hi.
Thanks for holding on for us.
This is such a valuable contribution. And I related to the comment about the grasshoppers because I saw that happen, and when I try to tell people about it, they really don't believe me. And that crunching sound, I was visiting my grandmother who was widowed and she was trying to farm in north central Kansas, and we were in her living room, I think it was just before lunch, and the big black cloud came in from the west, and it was dark. We couldn't see. It was not completely dark, but dark for noontime. And I don't know how long it took, but it didn't take very long for those grasshoppers to devour the entire cornfield, which was her income for that year, and it went down to the stubble. And I remember that crunching.
Mickey, how did she react to this happening right outside?
Well, she was an immigrant. She'd come to this country from Sweden when she was 9 years old, so she'd put up with a lot of stuff, and she just kind of like, well, I'll make the best of it.
Mm.
It was incredible. But I remember that crunching, that sound of the, and nobody will believe that if I try to tell that story. But anyway, this is such a valuable contribution, and we've all got to buy this book.
Thank you.
Mickey, that's a great memory, and thanks for sharing it with us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's say hi to Sharon from Excelsior. Good morning, Sharon.
Good morning. There was a long told tale. My father was born January 22nd, 1888, and he said in a covered wagon in Downs, Kansas. They could not get to a local town, close by town, for, you know, medical attention or a midwife or whatever. And I was wondering if this storm that your great authors talk about, it would be part of the same one that got into Kansas.
Yes, indeed. You know, I didn't come upon too many accounts from Kansas. I think it didn't get as much snow as Nebraska and the Dakotas, but it did get the cold temperatures, and that you know, severe cold outbreak that I was talking about, record temperatures were really all over the region, and there would have been blowing snow that mounted up. So, roads were blocked for many days because of this, and, with temperatures that cold, it was just hard for people to venture out. So, yes, indeed, that was definitely part of the same event. And, in fact, there are accounts that there was record cold all the way out to the West Coast and as far south as San Diego, which got me very excited until I started talking to meteorologists, and they said, no, that was something totally different. Mm-hmm. So that we can kind of put aside. But Kansas, definitely all part of the same big...
My father, having been born in 1888, I was curious, and I used to take the paper, the Capper's Weekly, and they had some books published that my folks claimed the plains, my folks claimed the prairie, and then it was people that had written in about their heritage, their family, and had mentioned this particular storm or a series of storms.
Sharon, thanks for your phone call.
Okay.
Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Let's say hi to one more woman here, Norma from Edgerton. Good morning, Norma.
Yes. I'm anxious to read this book because it makes me think of a book I read years ago. It was called Giants in the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that was the same storm that you were speaking of, or have you heard of this book?
Oh, I have definitely heard of that book. I've read it many times. I read it first when I was in... I guess it was in junior high, and I think I've read it three or four times since then, and every time I read it, I love it more.
You just
can
never forget that
thank
book.
Thank you very much that reminded you of that book. That is one of my favorite books of all time. And, you know, again, I don't know which storm in particular Rolfog was writing about, but it was definitely this region and this time. And
wow.
I've actually talked with some people who knew his family. He married into a big, sprawling Norwegian pioneer family. And so, yes, he was definitely writing about these same settlers that I'm writing about in the same series of winters. Now, I think at the tragic end of that book, which broke all of our hearts when we read it,
yes.
I don't think that was actually this particular storm that he had in mind. I think that happened later in the winter in any case. But, it's the same era and the same set of circumstances. So thank you very much for bringing that up.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Norma. Glad to have you. David, I wanted to ask you about so many of the stories you wrote about in this book, the vignettes about children being trapped in this storm. Riveting, wrenching stories, to be sure. How difficult was it for you to write these stories? Because it was hard to read some of them.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was definitely hard to write them. There's a chapter toward the end called Exposure, where I write about what happens to five of these Mennonite
yes.
schoolboys who wandered off, and I really describe the physiology of freezing, and that was really hard, and I just, if you've read that, you'll probably notice that I keep saying, at this stage, modern medicine could have saved them. You know, they mm-hmm. they could. This is really. People can be resuscitated, and it's actually amazing to me how close you can be. You can seem dead. You can really have no vital signs from hypothermia, and yet you can still be revived with no brain damage. And I just kept thinking, oh, golly, I wish that they had known that back then.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, I kept wanting a miracle to happen. Yeah, so, but I felt that I also really needed to describe, you know, kind of be as specific as I could. I think in some ways, you know, you feel you don't know what they were saying, and you can imagine what they were feeling, but we can know exactly what was happening to their bodies and to their hearts and eventually to their brains as this cold got deeper and deeper into them. So I felt that it was really important to describe this.
In several cases, you do describe what happens to individuals unable to open their eyes when the mm-hmm. snow is blowing at them so hard. How did you come up with that kind of detail for some of these examples that you write about?
Well, once again, thank goodness for the National Archives. Every weather observer back then was given a big vellum book of a kind of diary in which they were supposed to kind of keep track of everything that happened unusual. I mean, they, obviously they had to take the readings every day, but this was to jot down, well, severe storms, or they were very interested in rainbows and lunar and solar halos. Well, one of the observers named Sergeant Glenn, who was posted in Huron, South Dakota, wrote in his diary, and again, everybody, each day they probably got about 3 inches of space. Well, he filled the 3 inches and then stapled in 10 more handwritten pages about this storm, and just amazing detail. And I was just very lucky to, I mean, I had a whole stack of these that I was going through at the National Archives and just happened to stumble upon this, and it was just a huge help to me. And he was actually caught in the storm and lost briefly on his way home, and he was the one who described exactly what happened. He's the one who talked about the ice masks that form and the webbing of the eyelashes, and just why people were so disoriented and so unable to see. And then what happened was people, you know, this ice would form on their faces and people would scrape it off and claw it off, and then their eyes would become inflamed, and you know, their skin would become raw. So it was just, I mean, that to me was almost like having a movie of that day. I mean, his account was so vivid and, you know, just so intensely sympathetic with the people of the region. And he talks about, he said, you know, you may wonder why farmers went out to save their livestock. And he said, well, you know, for some people it was just that was the dividing line between poverty and survival. And, you know, they just felt if they don't save that stock, they're going to be left with nothing. So they were willing to take that risk.
Well, David, what are we left with in the aftermath of this storm? What's the enduring lesson of this tragedy? What can you tell us about that?
Well, I would say, first of all, respect Mother Nature. You know, we all, I think, we take our comforts for granted. But, you know, you don't have to get very far off the beaten track to be subject to the fury and the violence of nature. And, in fact, I was out doing an article in Montana this summer and was out at a very remote part with a woman who was driving me to see an old farm. And she told me a story about some neighbor of hers had lived in Montana all his life, you know, quite experienced, and just was out driving in his four-wheel drive and in the winter, and the door blew shut and, you know, it was locked, and you know, couldn't get back in his car and froze to death. So even with all of our modern conveniences, the weather can turn and we can really be caught out in it. And, you know, I think the other thing is just to think of the kind of big movements of history. You know, I think that we kind of had this attitude of we can conquer the land. We're giants in the earth. You know, we can prevail. And, you know, I think we have prevailed in many ways, but in many ways we haven't.
Right.
And I think we're still learning lessons from this land of ours. And many times we're learning them the hard way. And I think one of the lessons of this book is respect your environment. And you can't get to know it quickly. This is a land that requires deep respect and long learning to really get to know its secrets and its fury.
Well, David, thank you for your time, and best of luck with the book.
Well, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Steve Kraske's conversation with David Laskin about the Children's Blizzard originally aired in 2005. You can hear this show and our 2010 talk with Laskin about his book The Long Way Home, An American Journey from Ellis Island to the Great War at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow, two writers turn the tables on a book critic. Join us for that and our cold weather weekend to-do list. Our show is produced with help from KCUR's Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, Cody Newell, and Linda Scher. Enjoy the snow day. I'm Steven Steigman, and you are up to date.